2003, and first of all, I'd like to welcome back Representative Barnhart after a little extended absence.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's good to be back.
Had a few issues. We would have enjoyed the discussion, I'm sure. So look forward to having you get back into it again. What we'll do, colleagues, is first the introduction of the speaker-approved bills and the drafting requests, and then second, we will do House Bill 3601 as a work session, and then we will have public hearing and possible work session on HCR 42, and then end it with a public hearing on HB 2443. And you do note HB 3442 on the agenda. We will not be considering that this afternoon and hold it over to another day. So with that, let's then open up the work session on possible introduction of speaker-approved bills and measure drafting requests. Representative Forrest.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I missed which bill is being held over.
3442. Mr. Chair, I move Legislative Council drafts 3555, 3556, and 3558 be introduced as committee bills.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved Legislative Council drafts 3555, 3556, and 3558 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Any objections? If not, so ordered.
No drafting requests.
So we can then move on to work session on House Bill 3601. And I know we have an amendment.
Representative is here. I don't know if she wants to talk about her amendment or it's the dash one. It should be at your spot.
Okay. Representative Smith and Colonel Caldwell, you know, come forward.
Thank you. And for the record, I'm Representative Patty Smith, District 52.
I'm Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department.
All right. Thank you. In your testimony last week, there was discussion about proposed amendments, and is that what we're seeing with the dash ones?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is indeed what Legislative Council came up with. Representative Smith and I have communicated on this, and we're very pleased with those amendments. I would recommend the committee adopt them and move the bill.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3601.
Senator Flores has moved adoption of the Dash 1 amendments. Any discussion? Any objections? Anybody need any time?
I'm fine.
Anybody responding? Do you need any time?
I went
away. No. Think about it.
Wrong page. Oh, I see. Okay.
So, no objection? Without objection, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3601 as amended be moved to the floor with a due pass. As amended recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 3601 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. 3601 is amended for the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right, seeing none, let's call the roll.
President Backlund.
Aye.
President Reinhardt.
Aye.
President Close.
Excused.
President Corliss.
Aye.
President Wilson.
Aye.
President Burgess.
Aye.
Chair Doyle.
Aye. Let's see, we'll have, it did pass as amended, and Representative Smith will carry the bill.
Right.
End of work session then on 3601, and we'll open up a public hearing on HJR 42. And members, we anticipate the proponent of the bill to be here momentarily, but while we wait for him, we can go ahead and call forward Robert Neuberger and Judy Edwards, Multnomah Bar Association. And welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Introduce yourself.
Chair
to the committee.
My name is Robert Neuberger. I have with me today Judy Edwards, who is the Executive Director of the Multnomah Bar Association. I have the honor of being the President-elect. The Multnomah Bar Association is an professional association of over 4,000 lawyers in the Portland metropolitan area. We're a voluntary bar. There's no mandatory membership. Our membership is composed of lawyers of virtually every type that you can think of, civil, criminal, business, litigation, plaintiff, defense, you name it. We have a great diversity of type of practice and type of membership within our organization. We're here today to express our concern in opposition to HJR 42. By way of history, the Multnomah Bar Association has been involved in prior sessions involving legislation of this type, going back to at least 1999 when there was a similar proposal which we had concerns about in the last session, 2001 session. Representative Backlund, members of the Multnomah Bar Association, testified in favor of what was then HJR 7, which would have created a merit selection commission to supervise the selection of both appellate and trial judges. We feel that is a far superior method of adding a mechanism to the current system of judicial selection. As it is, of course, judges are elected. If there is a vacancy, they are subject to a gubernatorial appointment, and then they have to stand for election, and those are contested elections. We believe that HJR 42 is redundant and unnecessary. No other state in the union that we've been able to find has both Senate confirmation and judicial elections. There are some states that have Senate confirmation, and of course the federal system has it, but those are judges who are appointed and do not face election by the people. And we think that this, as our system is constructed in our Constitution, that it's superior to the proposal, and that is we have the people decide who they want to keep as their judges if they're appointed, and to elect in contested elections. We don't believe that the system is in any way broken, and this is a solution looking for a problem. We believe that judges should be selected based upon merit and not be a politicized process. We have been involved in the last election cycle, what were measures 21 and 22, because we were concerned that those proposals likewise would have threatened to politicize the selection and election of judges, which we think it's like, and I always have to apologize to Representative Backlund when I give my baseball analogies, it's like a big game. You want the best referee or best umpire. You don't ask them what party they belong to or what their views are on a particular hot button issue. You want the best umpire. And when you have a judge is a neutral officer. Their loyalty is one to the voters, of course, but secondly to the law. And this it's an independent branch of government. It's not an agency like you appoint someone to a commission. Those people don't face election. like judges do. We think that, in the words of former Governor Tia, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I think back to what Justice Campbell, who considered himself conservative, he was a trial judge, fine trial judge from Grant County, and been on both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. And he used to say he was a true conservative. And that meant if you were going to convince him to change the law, you had to show him that there was an exceptional reason why we ought to change the way we're doing it, and we suggest to you that's the way it is with this. If they are going to consider something, we think the judicial selection commissions are a far superior way to go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No.
Okay, any questions? Okay, thank you
very much.
Thank you.
No other scheduled to testify on this, is that correct? Okay, let's see, what we will do then, since we're still waiting for the proponent, is go ahead and recess the public hearing on HJR 42. And colleagues, with Representative Close coming in, looking to see if we can get her to vote on House Bill 3601. So if there are any objections to allowing Representative Close to vote on House Bill 3601, if none, yep. Let's we're going to reopen then House Bill 3601.
Thank you, Chair Doyle. I have a bill up next door, and so I was signing in and signing out, so I appreciate your courtesy, and I vote aye.
Thank you. Representative Close votes aye. Thank you. And that will close then the work session on House Bill 3601. Committee will just stand at ease for a moment. We can call back to order. We will go ahead and proceed on with the public hearing on House Bill 2443. We'll just see what happens if the proponent does show up. If not, we'll continue moving on. So then with House Bill 2443, go ahead and open up a public hearing and ask Mike Dewey to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I understand Representative Patridge is the proponent of the bill.
Correct.
And if he appears, I'm more than happy to accommodate his schedule and go like that.
Okay.
I will stop speaking.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
The companies that I represent, Oregon Cable Telecommunications, cable telecommunications companies provide obviously cable television service in Oregon, in many cases to a large portion of the state, high-speed cable modem service, internet service, and in Portland, Comcast provides local exchange service in competition to Verizon and Quest and perhaps some smaller telephone companies. So as you can see, a variety of different services, and because of the significant competition in the telecommunications marketplace, it makes sense to diversify as much as you can, because that competition changes almost on a daily basis. We support House Bill 2443. We think it is a very straightforward piece of legislation. It is not a prohibition for, now, I'll use the term cities here, but I'm talking about counties or other entities created by local government with regard to how the bill is written. But we'll talk about cities as analysis to local governments. Let me tell you first what the bill does. There was a similar bill last session that it's nice to be able to bring my friends back into the hearing today and back in the, hopefully they're, many of them are out of town, and hopefully they're spending some money in Salem. We need the economy to do well here, so I suggest they stay, and if we can have additional hearings, that's fine with me. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to move aside and let the Honorable Rob Patridge come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Dewey. Let's then recess House Bill 2443, and we will reopen public hearing on HJR 42.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize to the committee for being late. We had a time-sensitive bill we had to get out as well, and I didn't have my senator show up, but my House members were there. I'm happy to report to the House Rules Committee. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate you taking up House Joint Resolution Number 42. House Joint Resolution Number 42, I have proposed a two amendments, which I believe that Kara has distributed to the committee. The rationale for bringing House Joint Resolution 42 is that I believe, and my research has indicated that really that there is not a public process currently. We have three branches of government in Oregon that are supposed to balance each other out. We have our own legislative body, we have the judicial branch, and we have the executive branch. At the current point in time, it appears that most of the time members of the judicial branch choose to retire ahead of an election and receive an appointment by the governor, but there's no public process involved in that. There's no public process mandated by that, and there's really no public vetting that occurs like we all experience as an election. There are elections. These people do have to stand for election as a judge, but part of the problem in standing for an election as a judge is that there is a chilling effect which is out there, that lawyers don't run against incumbent judges or judges typically that have been appointed by the governor. If you go back over the history, and I tried to have my staff do that, but it's a very, very difficult and convoluted process. I'd be happy to share my spreadsheet that we tried to help put together, but it was very, very difficult in working with the Secretary of State to try and go back over the course of history, since many of these judges have sat for many, many years. Typically, judges are not run against, and I believe that it's important that we have a public process whereby these individuals are vetted and they're not just appointed by the executive branch in and of itself. I think that we require Senate confirmation and have Senate confirmation for much less important things than a judicial system. And as this body well knows, many of the decisions that have been made by the judicial system over the course of time have dramatically altered what our ability is in the legislature, and have also dramatically altered the landscape of the state of Oregon. And I feel that it's important that that we have a public vetting, as well as these people stand for election. Can stand for election, but realistically that doesn't happen. I propose the dash two amendments to this that would require Senate confirmation, but it has a 120-day rule. So that meaning that that the Senate would have to act to either affirm or reject judicial appointees that were put forth by the governor within 120 days. The Senate typically meets on a quarterly basis in order to deal with appointments and other things during the interim, and this would allow an adequate time period in order for those things to happen. The Senate could do its own process, but it would avoid some of the drag that occurs at the federal level. The federal drag that occurs is, you know, as you are well aware of, is that, you know, both sides argue that there's politics involved in this, and it is a political office in our state because it's an elected office, but we didn't want to be, if a governor put somebody forward, to then perpetually just sit in a queue and the Senate not bring the issue forward under consideration. And that, I think that that was, I bring that forward to address concerns of many of the opponents, and also to for the expediency that we need in the judicial system in Oregon. It's unfair, I believe, to leave people hanging out there for substantial periods of time. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you for the committee's indulgence. Again, I apologize for being late, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Patridge, we had testimony earlier that we don't need this bill. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. However, when Judge Michael Gillette was here, I asked him how many of the sitting judges of the Supreme Court they're now sitting were appointed originally, and he said he thought it was 4 out of 6. I was wondering if you know on the Court of Appeals how many of the sitting judges were first appointed.
No, I don't. Honestly, Representative Close, off the top of my head, I could give you a whole series of, but unless I was able to page through all the appellate judges, which I don't have them broken out by appellate or trial judges, I could do that, but it is my belief that most of the judges are generally appointed in the state.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Would it be fair to say that by being appointed, then it becomes very easy then to be elected after having been appointed?
I think it does become very easy to, Mr. Chair and Representative Close, it does become very easy for them to get elected. And I will tell you that I do believe that as somebody who is a lawyer who's been involved in the process and who's watched judicial elections around the state, when somebody has opposed a gubernatorial appointee, that there is a substantial chilling effect that occurs within the local bars if anyone runs against a sitting judge. And I do believe that that is a, I do believe that that is a substantial problem.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. We have. It's been said that this has great potential for becoming very political. And, you know, many of us in this body have been appointed, and then usually once you're an incumbent, the incumbent always wins. So it's not just judges. It's representatives and senators, too. But how do you respond to that regarding the politics of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I believe whether you're in the majority or the minority on this issue, I think that this offers an opportunity for either side to have a public say in who gets appointed to be judges throughout the state of Oregon. Currently, that doesn't occur. Currently, the governor is not bound by any particular process. He or she, whoever the governor may be, is not bound by a bar pull, is not bound to follow any particular process. Typically, in the tail end of this last administration, people who put their names forward for judges were only vetted by people within the governor's office, and not other. Other models have been proposed where you have a kind of judicial commission But I believe that there deserves to be a public vetting for people that make such important decisions. If a state representative vacates their seat, it's my understanding typically that the county commissioners, and I think that that's statutory, I'd have to go back and look, that the county commissioners actually appoint the person. And there is a public vetting. There's an opportunity to have some input. And it's not just, the decision is not just left to one person. This involves more people in the public process. This is a public process, and judges are public figures and make substantial decisions that affect the state of Oregon and individuals in the state of Oregon as we move forward. And I think that it's only fair to allow both the majority and minority, no matter who's in control, to at least be able to have a say and have a vetting of the individuals who go forward.
Follow up. And one last piece. We had the Multnomah Bar Association saying that this would be probably the only state that would have both elections and an appointment process. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't know state to state, and we've tried to do some research in looking state to state. All I know is I'm trying to circumvent, I feel like the current process circumvents a public process, and all I'm trying to do is insert some more public comment into a public process because there is no public process now. There's a dozen different ways that you can do this. You could make these lifetime appointments if that's what you wanted to do for judges, and then have a Senate confirmation like they do in the United States Senate. There's a dozen different ways to do this. But I think if you want to have co-equal branches of government, when one branch has such a substantial say all by themselves, and there is no public process that's required, it violates the sensibilities of having a public process. You know, we've all been under, there's been scrutiny within the newspapers about caucuses and public process, and in this whole bill, there is no public process for judges, and they've probably made some of the largest decisions that have affected the state over the last few decades. They've made some of the most substantial decisions, and they have had no public vetting.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Patridge, the Supreme Court judge that appeared before us confirmed what you've just said. That he, I think he said the big majority, 93 to 95% mm-hmm. of the elections had no opposition. The thing that bothers me here is once the people elect someone, whether they're opposed or not opposed, then the Senate comes along and doesn't confirm what the voters have voted on. What do you see would be problematic about that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Verger, that's not what this bill does. What the bill does is require only in the case of a gubernatorial appointment. So if a judge retires midterm, the governor is allowed to appoint. It only requires, if the governor appoints midterm, that it requires a Senate confirmation. If a judge retires and it's an open election, then it's an open election, but then there's no incumbent. Now, even if the governor appoints somebody and they haven't stood for an election, they still get a mark of incumbency in the voter's pamphlet and in their and on the ballot that they are the incumbent when they've never even stood for an election before.
Follow up. But that doesn't really take care of all of the problem if there is a chilling effect of people running against someone in an election. Don't you still have a problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, the problem with the chilling effect is if you have an incumbent judge who's already served an election, at least, and they haven't been appointed previously, at least somebody has had an opportunity to run against them when they weren't an incumbent. At the case in point, what happens now is judges retire right towards the end of their elected term right on the bench, and then the governor has the opportunity to appoint someone. And then that person gets to serve as the incumbent and appears as the incumbent on the ballot. And that's the chilling effect that I'm talking about, is there's no public process. What this does is insert a public process so that if somebody is appointed, there's a public process that occurs ahead of that, rather than somebody just walking in when the governor decides how whatever process he uses behind closed doors to as his appointment process.
Right. Other questions?
One
more. Sure. Representative
Mossinger. I know you're saying that there isn't a public process, but when there are these appointments that are coming up recent or that are coming up, or maybe they've been appointed, I don't know, but a number of us were asked by certain people who wanted to be appointed to write letters, and I'm sure maybe all of us have done that over the last couple of years serving as state representatives. So in a sense, don't you think that input is being given by those of us who have been approach by people who do want to be appointed? You know, I'm sure names, I don't understand the process, but I would assume names are submitted to the governor and then he chooses and then he looks at. Can you explain a little bit about the process? The governor's office doesn't seem to be here to.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moss Anderson, there isn't a public process that the vetting occurs. Typically, what happens is if you know somebody, they're going to come and ask you because you're a state representative to send in a letter on their behalf. But nothing happens on the other side. No, if there's a problem with a person's background, if there's other issues in regard to a person, nothing occurs on the input typically on that side because it's not solicited input. Also, the only people that make the decision are the governor and the governor's staff on a lot of these circuit court appointments, and you know, it depends on whatever process the governor wants to have. The governor's not bound to any particular process nor to take anything into account as a result of this. This just opens up the public process so that a variety of people will have an opportunity to have their voices heard. And especially without having such a substantial chilling effect as occurs right now, if people want to run against a judge.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Representative Patridge. Representative Close mentioned earlier that Supreme Court Justice Gillette indicated he thought it was about 4 of 6 of the current judges were appointed. The chart that you said that you were in the process of preparing or had worked on, does that somehow track appointments versus elected judges over a period of years? Is that what the purpose of your tracking was?
Mr. Chair and Representative Flores, that's what we attempted to do, but the history, we'd have to go back and peel through every single voter's pamphlet and every appointment. The Secretary of State, as recently, has kept some track of the appointment process and some track of the election process, whether anyone stood for an election, but that is lacking the substantial staff to be able to address the issue. All I can tell you is I believe that that is the case, and from the initial results that we got, I that confirms that.
Follow up?
Sure, follow up.
Then do I understand what I think I'm understanding is, and perhaps you can direct me, what your bill is proposing is that apparently there is some type of perhaps political gamesmanship in the perhaps the retirement periods of judges, so that they retire and can be appointed during the time that the Legislative Assembly is no longer in session. Is that it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I would say that there is some degree of gamesmanship that does go on, because there is no political process that occurs as a result of the appointment process. I do believe that, and I think that while you probably couldn't get somebody to resign to tell you that, off the record, I think that people have expressed that view to me on numerous occasions who've said, I wouldn't be willing to resign. Or I would resign, depending on who happened to be the governor at the time.
Other questions? Just Representative, on that last issue, the do you know when a judge stands for election, or when it's left open to be an open election? At what point during the interim, not interim, but during the period before the election period, that they can resign, get appointed, have somebody appointed, and they're considered an incumbent versus having to wait until the next election day?
Mr. Chair, Dave Hendricks and I went over part of that to make sure that the proposed amendment wouldn't run afoul of that. I cannot tell you off the top of my head in any great detail as to when things fall off and when they don't. You know, there's certain appointment rules that if it's within so many days of an election that they stand and then they run at the next general election. So there's a whole special series of rules in dealing with this. In talking with Mr. Hendricks and in drafting this amendment, we tried to be cognizant of those, that it wouldn't have any adverse effects as to that.
Okay. And had my question answered by our administrator already.
You're a capable administrator, I'm sure.
Absolutely. It's if the vacancy occurs more than 61 days prior to the general, then it's considered an appointment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Batman.
Thank you. Representative, I notice in the dash 2, the 120-day limit. And I'm also thinking if there were a vacancy during the interim, I presume then that we would the Senate would have to call itself into a special session, or the governor would call them into special session?
Mr. Chair and Representative Backlund, it's my understanding that they try and meet on a regular basis to deal with these appointments, but other appointments as well. And this would accommodate their schedule. I think they try and meet on the same schedule that we meet quarterly with the emergency board, which members of this committee have served on and the chair served on in that capacity during this last year. That should accommodate this. We gave them an extra 30 days in order to make sure that that they would be able to meet in time. I'd ask for your support to send this over to, if the Senate sees a problem with it, with the House, and you know, I tried to at least vet this to some degree with people over there who seem to think it would be okay.
Anything further? Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Backlund.
I hate to say this, but I've been doing a lot of thinking. It's always a dangerous thing. I think on this bill, I've spent a lot of time kind of looking at both sides. I even drew a line down the middle of a piece of the paper and wrote down some pertinent things. Reread the testimony by Justice Gillette. And I've also talked to a number of people since then. And I guess I came in today prepared to vote no on HJR 42, but I think the dash 2 amendments kind of switches my view to the other side. It does avoid the situation that we see in the United States Senate, where I think it's been a long time since a federal judge has been confirmed by the U.S. Senate, because we have a 120-day period. And so probably that is the reason, or that is the difference in terms of my thinking process. And so I think I would support this bill with the dash 2 amendment.
All right. Other discussion or public hearing? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to make these comments now, but I think they're timely. Oregon has every state has different systems for appointing or electing or whatever they do to get judges. These processes work well or badly. There are some states in which the political process is paramount and the justice system suffers accordingly. Everyone's heard about Texas justice and the difficulties, the necessities of raising large amounts of campaign funds in order to run, and the corrupting effect that that has on judicial elections in Texas. Oregon has worked itself into a system that actually functions, and it actually functions quite well. The key issue in getting judges into state courts are finding competent people who will consider cases carefully and impartially, make decisions that conform to the evidence that they have in front of them, and the basic law of the land. And that's a tall order in some situations. Oregon has been remarkably successful in finding competent judges who will do exactly those things. We've had very great success in doing it. And I think I know some of the reasons why, and I'd like to amplify them on if I may. The biggest problem in getting good judges is to get lawyers who are willing to give up lucrative practices in order to become judges, usually for a pay cut. We don't want people as judges who are beginners or people who are unsuccessful in their practices, because usually the reasons for that also make them either wild cards or not appropriate people to have as judges. As a part of the process of getting people to give up lucrative practices in order to take on the public duty of being a judge, one of the things that's happened over time has been what Representative Patridge refers to as the chilling effect, but which I consider an appropriate protection from the political process for competent, good, neutral judges. And it works sort of like this. If the governor appoints people to fill a vacancy who are competent and are going to do a good job, the bar has a tacit understanding that you don't run against those people. Why? Well, again, because we want people to put their names forward for these appointments or for election who are competent, who will be making sacrifices in their personal income or perhaps in other ways in order to fulfill this role, this very important role in the public service. Now, let's suppose the governor makes a mistake. We have checks in the system that are very important checks. The first one is that there is an election. Every 6 years, a judge has to stand for election. In the event that a judge has done a poor job, has made bad decisions, has gotten editorials in the newspaper locally, and you all know, you've all seen them, you know this happens, it is quite possible for a lawyer to put his name forward or her name forward and run against that judge. And there have been judges who've been defeated in those kinds of elections as a result of the way they've conducted themselves in office. There also is the Judicial Fitness Commission, which is designed to help judges or deal with judges who have demonstrated in one form or another that they're unable to carry out their duties, and they can be discharged as a result of that. I have to agree with the bar, the Oregon Bar, and also with the Multnomah Bar Association. We have a system. Whether theoretically it ought to work or not, it does work. We ought to keep it. I plan to vote no on the proposal.
Okay, thank you. Let's now go into work session on House Bill 40 or HR 42. Further discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Close.
I'd first like to make a motion that we accept the Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you. Representative Close has moved adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to HR 2 or HR 42. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And
Mr. Chair, I would move HAR 42 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Close has moved HAR 42 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just a comment. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had Republican governors and Democratic governors who have made appointments throughout the many years, and I will concur with the eloquent words of the representative from Eugene that Eugene Close that the system does work.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barnhart, you had something further?
Just briefly, and I didn't make this point earlier. Allowing for a political hearing on appointment before the Senate opens up the possibility that you reduce the pool of competent, good lawyers who you want to have taking these jobs, especially in places where the number of lawyers may be smaller. And it worries me that we would be making changes to a system which at this point functions quite well. We have a very competent circuit court bench in Oregon.
Thank you. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say that I support this bill. I think we've had important testimony that a problem does exist. Either our Oregon judges are elected or they're appointed. It shouldn't be both. Appointment should be used in a limited manner, I believe. It should not be the norm. And it appears that it has become the norm in the majority of cases if you look at the numbers of sitting judges who were first appointed. So I think it's an important concept. I like the way that it goes to the people for their approval or rejection. I think we need to allow them this vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none. Let's take a roll.
Aye.
No.
Vote time.
Representative
Flores?
Aye.
Representative
Mullins
Anderson?
No.
Representative Bridger?
No.
Chair Doyle? Aye. HJR 42 as amended passes to the floor, and we'll have Representative Patridge carry this bill. And we'll close the work session on HJR 42 and reopen the public hearing on HB 2443. Mr. Dewey? Thank you for your patience.
No problem. Interesting conversation. Mr. Chair, again for the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I was starting to get into the bill itself, and I do have amendments being drafted, which I will discuss later with you regarding this particular bill. As I said earlier, the bill is fairly straightforward. What it does is, before a city, a county, or an entity of the local government was created by the local government, before they commence the provision of telecommunications services, now this is the key, at retail, not amongst intergovernmental entities. There are some other exemptions that we'll talk about later, but these are at retail, where in essence they are competing with private providers who are in the marketplace, and there are an array of private providers. They must do a few things. First of all, it would seem to make sense that they should at least do a financial pro forma. Again, these are competitive industries. Telecommunications is very competitive. And there is a possibility, if you get into this business, that you may go, usually cities don't go bankrupt, but something very similar to that, where you look at it and say that we're not getting a return on investment, we're not breaking even because the competition is killing us, or we misread what the competition would do in terms of the technology that we offer. And this allows the public to have the opportunity to see whether or not the financial pro forma is something that is realistic. In other words, what is your revenue going to be over this period of time, and what are your expenses? In terms of the revenue, if we use Ashland, for example, they did a financial pro forma, and they made assumptions based on a survey that by year three we would have so many cable customers and we would have so many high-speed internet customers. And it was a good opportunity to have, at least in Ashland, to have that discussion. And I would assume that a good accounting firm would do that in terms of what are the possibilities of entering this business, and does it make sense for you? Now, let me say that kind of ironically, and when I've talked to some of you about this, the city of McMinnville, or an entity of the city, received a grant of $100,000 from the Mid-Willamette Council of Governments. This is really kind of pass-through money. This is lottery money to study the feasibility of owning and operating a telecommunication system. And personally, I find that astounding, that in this environment we would spend $100,000 on this kind of a study, if you will, where you have a state-of-the-art cable system, and Verizon is the local exchange company, and they have a very good service in that particular area. And, of course, there is other competition. So here, in this case, without this bill, you have the city getting $100,000. The next provision is that you must hold at least one public hearing. And it would seem to make sense that a city, a county, would do that to find out what do the people really think about this, if there are objections, to get them on the record. Some of the information that heretofore didn't come out might come out in a public hearing, and the elected officials could then decide whether or not they want to move forward. Now, the last piece of this, and I would presuppose to hear the arguments against this bill, and this is that the voters must approve the debt, if you will, or the financial structure by which this is being contemplated. In other words, the voters have the chance to say, yes, we think we need this service in our community, or no, we don't think it's needed, primarily because we have other services that we need to provide that are essential services, and in fact, we may have some financial problems based on the pro forma. Now, as I said, this is not about Ashland, but to a degree, I think we have to talk about what has happened in Ashland. I will do that, but let's say, and I will tell you that Ashland did not have a vote. They borrowed initially $5.8 million, and a few years later borrowed another $2.52 million without a vote. Now, the amendments that I would bring before you are amendments that would, first of all, exempt any entity that is in the business today, contemplating that they're already there, notwithstanding the fact that they didn't have a vote, they're already in business, and it would not be good public policy, in my mind at least, in my client's mind, to require a vote at that point in time. We are contemplating, and I would work with the opponents on this, for those that have made significant efforts and made significant investments, we would try and find a way to exempt those parties from this requirement because they have made those investments and they may be developing infrastructure. And so we're going to take a look at that. But it does seem to me that that's the big issue. And really for you, the public policy issue is local control on one hand, and as we talk about some policy questions that I will bring up in just a minute. Last session, when we brought a similar bill before you, we did not bring up the public vote until later in the session. We had basically an accounting provision that said that for these kinds of entities, there could not be any cross-subsidies. And I want to, if I can, remind you that there is, I'm not saying that any of these entities that are in the business are cross-subsidizing, but I'm saying there is the potential to do it in a big way. The common denominator when a city or a county gets into the retail telecommunications business usually is that the city owns the power company or has some sort of interest in the power company, created the power company. And that would be the case in Ashland. Now, recognize that if you have the power company over here and you've got your telecommunications system over here, you have these assets already available. You've got legal, you've got accounting, you've got a customer service, and what we wanted to do in the previous legislation is make sure that you imputed your direct and indirect costs. Your direct costs would be what are on the books in terms of your assets to build that system, and then your indirect costs are what does it take to run it, because you would arguably have a lawyer or lawyers who work on both sides of the street, on the cable side, and we wanted to make sure that some of the bellables didn't go over to the electric side to lower your cost where there's competition and increase your cost where there's not competition. Because there's not competition in most cases in the electric business. But we didn't pursue that because for a number of people it was somewhat confusing. We talked about accepted accounting practices and the cities and counties said we already do that. We're not going to have any cross subsidies. And so we came before you and said, you know, it does seem to make sense that because this is such a specialized area, because the competition can be so intense, and we'll talk about that in just a minute, that a vote should be required. So as I said, on the one hand, you have the issue, and I've heard it, of local control, and you have a number of bills that deal with that, and some of you are ironclad in the sense that I'm for local control, and then for some of you, you know, in this case, this is not an essential service, and I think we have to have another mechanism, or sometimes you're in between. And there's a piece of legislation out there on local control you know about that's getting a lot of press dealing with tourism and so forth. So you have the policy question of local control versus these questions. Should tax-subsidized municipal entities be allowed to compete directly against private companies? In this case, providing telecommunication services. You already have private providers. You have a private cable provider, and I will get to, if you don't, in rural areas, I will get to that argument in a few minutes. You've got, if you're in that business, you've got the direct satellite broadcast folks, and believe me, they are significant competitors to my clients, cable companies, in terms of market share. Their market share is growing. So not only are you dealing with the local cable company and competing there, you're dealing with the DBS provider. And then you're dealing with, probably if you're going to build this infrastructure, you're going to provide internet service, high-speed internet service, and you'll compete most likely with the cable company and the telephone company that provides DSL service. Essentially the same services, one over the telephone system, one over the cable system. And then at some point in time, because you're in the business, you may get into the telephone business, the voice business, because you're talking about, this is really a digital business, and all we're talking about are O's and 1's in terms of how you transmit whatever services you're going to be providing. So basically, you're in a situation where there is a tax-subsidized municipal entity. The creation of the city is tax-subsidized, obviously. The next question is, should a local government or a business that is highly competitive with the possibility of losing money, literally going broke? And I would say to you, and this was the situation in Tacoma, where there was some consideration in the year 2000, and this is, Tacoma has a telecommunications service called CLIC, and it would compete with Comcast and the local telephone company in terms of DSL service, modem service, and cable service. And they had some discussions about selling the network. But I would say to you, in terms of selling the network and its book value, in terms of its assets and what you would sell it for based upon its book value, you would never get the value out of that system. And the reason being is because usually there are redundant systems already there. The cable company has a redundant system compared to the telecommunications system owned by the city. So when somebody says, well, if it doesn't work out, we'll just sell the system. In Tacoma, when they asked at the time AT&T Broadband, would you buy it? They said, no, we wouldn't. We might buy portions of it, but we wouldn't buy the entire plant because we already have plant in the ground and above ground that is essentially the same. We have wires going into the home when you're in the street. We have a head in. We have a state-of-the-art facilities to do all of those things. And I would submit that cities and counties are not very entrepreneurial to begin with. Now, I'm not saying that as a negative. I'm just saying that they don't have to be. They're in the police business, which is essential. They're in the fire business. They're in the business of building roads or contracting that out. But they have the things that they do, and they don't compete. And when they get into the real world of competing, I mean, how do you set the price? You're dealing with customer service and all of those kind of things. So what I'm saying in part is, if they're not entrepreneurial, something may happen. And the competition is not going to go away. One of the benefits of the competition is maybe lower prices. Because the city, and again the city getting into telecommunications, in most cases, because they do not have a single customer to begin with, they will have to set their prices below the competition, or fairly close to it, unless you have an actor, a private company that is not reacting to the market very well, and people want to switch because of that. And that may happen in certain instances. But the point is, you're going to have your prices below the competition. And the competition at that point in time, and this is where it's maybe decent for the citizen of that particular area, is the competition has to decide whether or not they're going to lower their rates. If they lower their rates, obviously they lose revenue. If they don't lower their rates, they may lose customers. So it's somewhat of a catch-22. Where this has occurred in some communities, some companies have lowered rates, others haven't. Basically say, we're just going to fight it out in the marketplace and see what happens. Now, as we talk about Ashland, I talked about McMinnville. The good representative to my left knows that Eugene has been interested in taking a look at this, has put this off for a variety of reasons, and we can get into that, but perhaps time won't allow. The city of Portland is looking at this, and the city of Eugene has a relationship with EWEB. McMinnville has the power company there that they have a relationship with regard to a charter. And then, interestingly enough, the city of Portland has made some declarations of being in the telecommunications business if they were to own and operate PGE. And PGE, you may have seen an article in the paper Sunday, and this really isn't the Enron debacle, but PGE invested in the telecommunications marketplace. They spent a whole host of dollars, small compared to their revenues and their expenses. But the PUC was concerned about that because basically that is a bankrupt entity. And they were going to get into the voice video business, and they found out that it was just going to be too expensive and they may not be able to do that in the marketplace. But if Portland buys PGE, one of the things they will look at is being in the telecommunications business because they have talked about that. Now, interestingly, I think the only other entity that's in the cable business is the city of Cascade Locks. And we would obviously exempt them. They've been in the business for many, many years, and it's kind of an anomaly. They had an RFP, and nobody responded to the RFP to build. And, you know, if that were the case, obviously I don't think you would need a vote of the people. But we're beyond that because literally every community has some sort of telecommunications service. You can get satellite service, you know, literally anywhere in the state of Oregon if you don't have wired cable television available to you. As you know, a few years ago, this body, actually 4 years ago and then 2 years ago, this body talked about electrical deregulation. And you're not talking about this session, and rightly so, for a lot of reasons. A number of the companies, cities that were looking at this, looked at it from the standpoint that they needed to diversify. They thought they were going to lose customers because of electrical deregulation. And as we know, really there's not too much choice in the marketplace in terms of deciding who your power company is going to be. But the play they made was to piggyback on their investment in telecommunications facilities, but they found out that, you know, quite frankly, there was no competition in the marketplace. And that didn't happen. But they have now and continue to have a monopoly in the marketplace. The other question is basically, is it efficient for a city or a county to own telecommunications facilities? And I would say to you that I think this is a fair statement that economists generally agree that government agencies, where there are valid comparisons, are much less efficient than private companies, especially where advanced technology and innovation is in the mix. I have conversations with friends and others to say that the companies that I represent in the wired world are going to be obsolete down the road because wireless is where we're going to be. And so the question is, do you invest in wireless as a city, or do you invest in wireline, or do you do both? And you make a mistake, and if you make a mistake, you pay. And if you make a mistake and you pay, the citizens pay because you've lost money in the marketplace. I mean, is it fair is another question. There are two factors. And this is kind of disturbing for my clients. At the local level is where cable companies are regulated. You have to have a franchise. They are non-exclusive franchises, so I want to make that very clear. A city cannot proffer up an exclusive franchise to a company and say, you're the only one. If other companies want to come in and build, they may. You don't see much of that. You saw a couple of companies 3 years ago try and get into the business in Portland. And they were getting franchises from the city of Portland. They were putting plant up, but they never operated because the telecommunications sector went like this. And again, that could happen to a city very easily. But it's almost like in the baseball analogy earlier, that here you are, your competitor is also your regulator. And it's bringing to a baseball game, Representative Backlund, today I'm bringing my umpires, and you can bring your umpires some other time. Now, that's the way it is, and we can't do anything about it. But the question is it very fair in the marketplace? And I submit it's not. Also, if you look at it, the power company would own the poles, and we would need attachments to those particular poles. I'm not going to talk about pole attachments today, thank God. Taxes, they don't pay taxes. The companies I represent pay taxes. So as I get through this issue, I mean, obviously there are some questions about fairness. I just saw a particular franchise renewal contract that was very onerous. And if a city were in the business of being a competitor, they would gain some substantial amount of information from this company. Their competitor, by virtue of having that information and being able to acquire certain information in that particular proposed contract. Again, that's somewhat onerous. Mr. Chair, I have a few more comments and then I will finish up. I know you've got a very busy schedule here. I'm going to try and filibuster these people in the back. I did want to talk just briefly about Ashland. We had Davis Wright from Maine, which is a law firm in Portland last year, do an analysis of the Ashland system. But let me say it's a very good system. They provide excellent service. It's a state-of-the-art service. They borrowed $5.8 million initially, borrowed another $2.5 million to complete the build-up. So they were off by $2.5 million. In part, they used, as I understand it, in looking at the numbers, they used part of that to pay off the inter-fund transfers. Because in essence, there hasn't been enough money from the cash flow, so they're using inter-fund transfers, and I'll get into that in just a minute. But if you look at their financial pro forma, and you start with their first pro forma, then their revised, and their last one, which was November of 2001, in 2006, they said they would have revenue in that year of $6.3 million. Now, these are as close as I can get on a bar graph. Okay, so it could be off by 100,000. So give me some leeway there. In their revision, they now say they will have in 2006 3.8 million. Now that's a substantial difference in terms of where they thought the economy was going to be for their revenues as to where it is. Let me just read from the executive summary from Davis Wright from Maine. Quote, based on the 2001 revised business plan, the total capital expenditures through June 2002, the AFN, it's called the National Fiber Network, will be approximately $7.4 million, while the outstanding debt load on the AFN will be $10.9 million, or a difference of $3.487 million. The sources of funding for AFN, other than revenues from services, is from interfund loans from other funds in the city and the initial outside loan to build AFN. So, I mean, obviously there is a set of funds over here, and they don't want to go into default, so they're using the interfund transfers that take place on a yearly basis. There was another study that looked at, this is out of the University of Denver, two economists, and they looked at a number of systems, and they looked at where the city owned the cable company. Their analysis of the financial is that two would never reach payback. The other would reach payback in 23 years for the initial investment. That doesn't assume additional upgrades that could be very costly because technology changes. I talked about Tacoma and Click. In December of 2002, they had discussions about selling the system, the Click system, or putting a surcharge on the electric bill, and they chose a surcharge on the electric bill. Obviously, the consumer can't be very happy about that. Let me talk very briefly about what may be a very compelling argument, and that is that the counties will say that if the private companies don't build it, then we ought not to have any constraints, and we need to build it for telecommunication purposes, for economic development. And I would agree with the argument about economic development, because telecommunications is very important. But if you make the assumption that the private companies are not going to build it, I would make the assumption in most cases there's going to be a subsidy somewhere. And you're going to have to take taxpayers' money to take care of that subsidy, to pay off whatever you're paying off. In that particular case, I think it is incumbent upon the voters to have a choice, because other services are going to be affected. Let's just assume it's $300,000 per year for a county to subsidize the network. Now, it's good for economic development, and over time it might create better growth. But what gives if it's $300,000? What if I do not want that particular service? Now, I'm the one that's going to be suffering, because in some degree I get less services because of that subsidy. There are exemptions in this bill for 911 services, notwithstanding the fact that we really didn't need to put those in because of the way it is written, for libraries. My colleagues who have an interest in this bill, other telecommunications providers, do not like the exemption, which is a kind of a local-to-local, or if you sell services from one government to another, telecommunications services, which is retail, because you're going to be receive some remuneration. They do not like that, but we thought that we did not want to quell that sort of investment between two governments. Now, there's a big loophole here, folks. A library could be set up by the city to run the telecommunications system, and they could avoid that. Now, I think that would be kind of a sham, and people would wonder what's going on if you had the library running the telecommunications service, and the library is the CEO or whatever the case may be. But nonetheless, we thought those services or those types of entities need to be exempt, because people were concerned about their library not being able to provide internet service. And 911 service is very important. And again, the exemption for kind of the local to local. So with that, Mr. Chair, the last thing I will say is, having a discussion with one of the officials about this kind of legislation in Ashland, they said, we're not going to require a vote for spending $5.8 million to build a cable system, because we're not requiring a vote of, I think, in the neighborhood of $20-plus million to build a wastewater sewage treatment plant. And if we're going to spend $27 million or $25 million, why would we do a vote on 5.8? And I said, well, the reason being is, you're going to get your investment back. You're going to be able to pay off the debt on the $27 million because it's a monopoly. There's no guarantee you're going to find that you're going to get your investment back on the 5.8, which came out to be an additional $2.52 million. So with that, Mr. Chair, I apologize for taking way too much of your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, good. Are there any questions?
Yes.
Marissa Moss Anderson.
I really like parts of the bill, because I do really feel that the government shouldn't really be subsidizing what the private sector can provide, or subsidize services that the private sector can provide. But could you tell me a little bit about Ashland, and is there cable outside the city of Ashland, and how do the rates compare? And is it pretty obvious then, if the rates are higher, that that the subsidy is really happening? Which?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Lourdes Anderson, I was yesterday. I'd asked for the information on what the rates were, and there was no attachment. And I sent an email back saying I need the attachment. So I'll do as best as I can. There may be a representative from Ashland here. Basically, when Ashland decided to get into the business of providing cable and internet service, they did a survey to find out how many people would want the service. And from there, they based their kind of their financial pro forma. They also figured out that there were kind of price points where people would take their service. So they said, now when we provide the service, notwithstanding knowing how much it was going to cost to build it, they said, this is what we're going to price the service at. And they priced it very competitive. Now, I'm not saying there are any subsidies in here by any means, because, I mean, we haven't looked. I will say that there was $125,000, and I was going to say this, 1 year, like in 2000, that showed up for administrative costs that the telecom system was to pay for the city that didn't show up in the next year in the budget. So I would call that a cross-subsidy. But they priced very competitive, and Charter Communications at the time made the decision to basically meet or beat their price. The one area they did not do that and again, I'm not an expert on their prices, was on the lowest tier. And the city of Ashland said, we want to make this as affordable as possible. The city of Eugene said the exact same thing when they were looking at it. But the city of Eugene recognized that, whoa, we're going to have way too many people taking this lowest tier because it is so cheap compared to other services. And for every customer we get, we're going to lose more dollars. And so I think over time they realized that they were having too many of their customers take this particular tier. It had the broadcast, public access, some other fairly nice channels on it. And Charter at that point in time decided not to lower their lowest tier package. Now, with regard to outside the area, you're asking a very good question. They did not, I believe, they provided service in the Medford area in southern Oregon. They were rebuilding the system. I do not believe that they changed the prices there. There was some concern about that, but they decided not to do that. Now, you still have the DBS provider that is providing a quality, pristine signal, so there's competition in the marketplace. Now, I understand in June prices are going to go down 15% in Medford. I don't know why, because that's normally not the case with programming costs. But what you do get, and I'll submit to this, you probably get, in the first few years, lower prices for everybody. But does that outweigh the investment and what might happen if it goes south on you? So hopefully I answered your question.
Okay. Thank you. I think that's all we'll have then for now.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Panel or members, we have a number of folks still wanting to testify in opposition of this bill. And we actually have, if you can believe, five different panels of individuals. And for those of you who haven't been to a Rules Committee meeting before, wouldn't know, but we have another committee that meets here at 3 o'clock. So we now have 35 minutes to complete these five panels. My suggestion certainly is that those of you who have written testimony, if you can just make a brief statement about that written testimony to summarize it, that would be helpful. And then with the rest of you, I mean, we're just not wanting to close out anybody's testimony, especially seeing that there are people who have come here from different parts of the state and wanted to deal with this. But, at this point, we are constrained by time, and I wanted to just make you aware of that. So if you can limit your statements to just a minute or two, and hopefully we'll get through everybody, and we'll just see if we can just take it as far as we can. We can see where we are at 3 o'clock. Let's see. Okay. Let's then call forward Helen Berg, Lou Ogden, and Tom O'Connor. Bill Penhollow, too. Did you want to come forward with this group or just?
Mr. Chair, I have written testimony, finally done with the committee, but with your indulgence, I would like to ask Mr. Bobet from Lincoln County come forward, either with this group or following this group.
Okay, thanks. We'll do that. Thank you. Okay. Mayor Berg?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Helen Berg. I'm the mayor of the city of Corvallis and treasurer of the League of Oregon Cities this year. With me is Mayor Lou Ogden of Tualatin, media past president of the League of Oregon Cities, and Mr. O'Connor. We will be very concise.
Thank you.
As you know, the cities of Oregon are where almost all the people in Oregon live, and even the ones that don't live in counties. So local governments are very important. We provide services. We provide services that only we provide. And we do that in a very responsible manner. And we have budget rules, which we must always comply with. We have totally transparent budgeting and accounting, and of course we're always very carefully audited. So any sort of investment that we make in order to provide services is very much open to the public. And believe me, our citizens pay very close attention. When it comes to deciding which kinds of services are most important at different points in our history, one very important consideration is always economic development. Economic development happens in the cities of Oregon, and because of it, there is revenue generated, which of course helps the entire state. Telecommunications are extremely important to economic development, and increasingly so as time goes on. So it is apparent to us that House Bill 2443 is a kind of a stake through the heart of home rule and our ability not only to set policy, but actually seems to impinge on our ability to decide local process with our own citizens that we probably know better than anyone else. And just because it hasn't been mentioned earlier, it has been brought to my attention that there are a couple of federal requirements that we ought to talk about. Federal law expressly provides that no state or local government may prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting any entity from providing telecommunication services. And secondly, federal law prohibits local governments from doing anything that creates a barrier to entry and also requires them to manage the public right-of-way on a competitively neutral and non-discriminatory basis. So we implore you not to pass any legislation which is one size fits all and allow us to go ahead with the good work that we do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Doyle, members of the committee. Again, I'm Lou Ogden-Mayor-Twalton and past president of the League of Oregon Cities. There are a number of people, as you already enumerated, here to testify with respect to the specifics, issues that have been brought up by the proponents of the bill, as well as issues that exist in cities across the state. I guess I would like to maybe elevate the conversation just a little bit different plane and really ask the question, what is the problem here that we're trying to solve? What is broken? What needs to be fixed by statewide legislation? The proponents have argued issues about the financial wherewithal of cities, the financial viability of providing this service, and I do appreciate the interest of the industries to make sure that cities are financially solvent. I would submit that there are any number of services that cities provide, that counties provide, and in fact the state provides, that could well be done by the public, by the private sector. And we can enumerate them ad infinitum. The issue really is, what is specific about this particular one that merits a statewide legislative fix? Whether we're talking about the issue of repairing automobiles with our police forces or your own state motor pool, whether we're talking about offering recreation services, and we have a perfectly good, probably the best private health club in the state of Oregon in Tualatin. Invite you all to come and visit Club Sport. But yet we provide recreation services in Tualatin, as many cities do, municipal swimming pools, municipal hospitals. And the list goes on and on and on, and we don't need to sit here and talk about the merits of all these various services, but I submit that what is unique about telecom that we need a statewide fix that says cities shouldn't be doing this and such without some prescriptive method. Now, I will certainly submit that the notions like doing a financial analysis, doing a projection, are meritorious, and probably a city shouldn't embark on any effort, even farming out its garbage collection, without looking at the pros and cons to both to the ratepayer, to the end user, and the cost and the value of that service and how well it's performed. But again, to specify one particular industry as needing a statewide fix because local government either is incapable or is in some way facetious or fallacious about how they want to represent the facts seems rather pointed to me. On the other hand, with regard to the notion of protecting the ratepayer or the taxpayer, again, what is the purpose of the bill in the eyes of the proponent? is it really that they're that concerned about the financial wherewithal of local government, and that we might embark upon something that we're going to pay for? And I can cite examples in local governments where we messed up financially big time, as well as county governments, as well as state government. And then we all know who those suspects are. I mean, those particular examples. And yet, do we need a statewide fix to make sure that in this one particular area, we don't stub our toe in that direction? I guess I would say that in many cases, in the business world, if you have a business entity and you can leverage your fixed costs or the assets or the trucks or the management staff or the maintenance staff or whatever to assume another business effort and spread those overheads, why would you not do that? If a particular community has a billing system, a power system, has fiber in the ground, has any asset or justification for absorbing another activity within that overhead, you know, we're told all the time, run government like a business. Tell me what's wrong with that. If it's an issue of barrier to entry with respect to competition, you know, as the mayor's already said, 1996 telecom bill from the federal government, very specific about that, and pretty liberal to the industry. And so the concerns about making it an uncompetitive situation probably don't play out. But I guess even if it were, I can go back to club sport in Tualatin if I want to use that example. Why do we provide recreation services at under market price in the city of Tualatin, taxpayer subsidized, with a perfectly good health club? I think it's because it's community value. If they want access, that people understand what we're doing with Parks and Rec, and they say that's a good value for their tax dollar. I submit to you that every city council is up for election every 2 years, if not the entire council, members of those council. If the population is concerned about the level of franchise fees or the level of the enterprise that we're involved in, whether we're farming out our grass mowing or whether we're doing telecom in-house or our own power company, they have the ability to participate in the budget process because the state requires a lay committee on the budget committee. They have the opportunity to participate in every public hearing. They participate in the grocery store when we're standing in line. And yes, they participate in the ballot box every 2 years when they come back to our council, just like they do to the state house representatives and say you're doing a good job. Or maybe you're not. We don't like the way our city's going. So I guess it goes back to this whole notion that by home rule, cities have implicit authority. In fact, in general cases, we have all authority except for what you folks, the state, decide we shouldn't be doing. Not altogether different than the federal government, the reserve clause, the powers to the federal government, except those enumerated go back to the states. Well, ours are just the opposite. Ours are already there unless the state takes them away. So I guess where there is a statewide public need that needs to be served and interest to do that, it seems appropriate for the state to come in and usurp the local ability. But I guess I submit, really, have we fleshed out what that problem, what that question is we're trying to solve today? And I would urge you to consider that notion on not just this bill, but any bill where it says a state will, in fact, tell a local government what it can or can't do or how it can do it, particularly with the authority we already have. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you, sir. Mr. O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is, for the record, Tom O'Connor with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. I'm here today on behalf of our organization, and particularly at the moment speaking on behalf of Ashland, and I'd like to maybe focus in on a couple of the issues that have been raised. Municipal electric utilities across the country are involved in telecommunications. There are several members here today or parts of other panels who will talk to you about what they're doing in their communities, Monmouth and Cascade Locks. But let me just go to a couple of points about Ashland because it was central to some of the points that Mr. Dewey made. First of all, the city of Ashland is a municipal electric utility. They also have a telecommunications utility which provides cable TV and internet access service to over 3,000 customers within the city within Ashland. The Ashland Fiber Network is operated as an enterprise fund of the city. It is a separate, completely, totally separate fund. It is not cross-subsidized in any way. The services that Ashland Fiber Network draws upon from the city, such as billing, use of utility bucket trucks, legal, you name it, that is billed those services are billed to the Ashland Fiber Network and they use them and those costs are recovered in rates. The city, the Ashland Fiber Network, pays the same franchise fees, pole attachment fees, to the city as does the cable companies and the other telecommunications providers. Those fees are the same. They're assessed against the Ashland Fiber Network the same way they are against the other providers. Now, that's a good way of doing business, but it's also, as been mentioned by Mayor Berg, it's federal law. We cannot discriminate or provide a barrier to entry, so we have to treat ourselves the same way that we treat the other folks. A point specifically to the question that Representative Morris Anderson asked, which is a good one, about rates inside and outside the city. The Ashland Fiber Network serves largely within inside city limits. They do have a contract for some wholesale services outside with Medford, but the incumbent cable provider in Ashland was Charter Cable Communications. It is Charter that provides, that charges different rates for the same service inside the city limits and outside, as opposed to outside the city limits. Ashland Fiber Network and Charter, their rates are about the same for basic services inside the city limits, but outside the city limits, Charter charges more for the same service. So it's not a question of the city subsidizing. It's a question of either somebody is either overcharging somewhere or undercharging somewhere else. I'm not sure which, but that information is from, it changes all the time with all these promotions and things like that, but that data is from about a year ago. Let me just make a couple of other points. City of Ashland has invested about $8.5 million to construct the network. They made a decision to build it out all at once. They have now hooked up pretty much the entire city is eligible to be on the system. They did have a revised business plan, as many telecommunication people involved in the industry did. They revised the business plan. They meet all of their debt service payments. They do some interfund transfers to for operating funds during the year. Those interfund transfers are repaid in full with interest at market rate every year. And the city's plan assumes that they will be positive cash flow in about 3 years, in the black in about 10. But I would emphasize that the ethic is a little different here. Their goal and the goal of most municipal electric utilities providing these services is to provide a service, not to go out and make a lot of money. I mean, I don't think we're not in that business. We're to provide a service at cost. In the packet I passed out, a couple of things I'll just quickly call your attention to. There is a letter from Ashland that describes some of the things I talk about. There's a letter from the Ashland Chamber of Commerce, and I'd just like to put statement that they've said that the Ashland Fiber Network allows a small city like Ashland to offer big city advantages to small businesses. It creates an environment that is attractive to new business and is promoted by the chamber as an incentive for business growth and development. And finally, I did also provide a list of the requirements that all municipal providers of telecommunications are subject to, such as local budget law, audits to the Secretary of State, open meetings law, Public Records Act. We do get certificates from the Oregon Public Utilities Commission as public, as competitive service providers, and we are subject to the federal requirements under the Telecommunications Act. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for indulging my list there.
Okay. Do we need questions right now?
One very short one.
Okay.
It is very short.
Only produce short answers.
I think, what services does AFN actually provide?
We've heard about cable. Do they provide anything else?
Mr. Chair, Representative, Ashland Fiber Network provides cable, internet access, data transfer, both to businesses and to residences.
Thank you.
Real quick, the bonds that were initiated for this telecommunication system in Ashland, how are they paid off? How is the debt being taken care of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morris Anderson, they are retired through the revenues from the system.
Right? That's what I wanted.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. John McArdle, Larry Dalton, Rob Bobit and Bill Penhollow.
We're going to speed you up. Okay. Help you speed. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. I'm John McArdle. I'm the mayor of Independence, Oregon, 12 miles from here.
Welcome.
Thank you. I want to make a couple just brief comments and reference a couple of things. This bill is bad for our community. We have a Monmouth and Independence have gone together and joined with Western Oregon University to build MyNet, which is a fiber optic system. The city and the chambers several years ago, I'm a past president of the Chamber of Commerce, we got talking a while back about what we could do for economic development. We wanted to be on the right side of the E-divide because otherwise you can only go 28K on your computer and that's not good for business. And so we talked about what was necessary. Our community has contacted the telecommunication folks back in 98 and 99. They were unwilling to provide cable broadband services to our community. We had a letter that said they wouldn't come till 2014, but then they moved that up to 2013. We didn't think that that was good for our community, and so we moved forward in a joint activity. This bill would limit our ability to provide services to our businesses, and the provisions, while they sound simple, are quite frankly an attempt to stifle what cities do to provide services. We already have a review process in place that was previously articulated, our budget process, our city council. We have an intergovernmental agreement between both of our cities and the university to do this. We've had joint city council meetings to talk about these things. We've had newspaper articles. Monmouth, their council meetings are on TV, and they play them over and over and over again. And think about that for a minute. And, you know, people know what's going on. This is a clear intrusion into local government authority. Clearly. You know, you've often complained, I've talked to many of you privately, and you folks have always complained about the federal government coming in and telling you what to do. Same thing. Cities, we already make tough decisions right now on cops, on roads, on sewers, on economic development, and then we have to live with those decisions every day. That means in the grocery store, I get hit up in the produce department, I get hit up on the ball field, or else when I'm mowing the lawn in the front yard and people come up and talk to you. And you folks know that, those of you who've been in municipal government have known that, and people will come up and talk to you. The other thing I want to point out is, what's the problem here we're trying to fix? The City of Independence, we're providing services that the utility was unwilling to provide to our local business and our citizens, and that's what we do, is we provide service. It's interesting. I'm going to hand the clerk something. Business Journal, April 4th, whole section about internet, the broadband, and what's going in here. And it references in here that NOAANet, which we're connected to, charges 50% less than the private sector. I wonder what they're complaining about here. And I think it's also interesting that, you know, there's the talk about this voter approval of where the funds are coming. Our funds happen to come from our Economic Development Loan Fund. We loaned it to ourselves. There was no, you know, so we're gonna pay that back out of the proceeds. But we have a loan fund specifically for this. Let's see, if you have an election, who's going to be funding the no vote? It's really interesting to me. Lest you think I'm alone, excuse my sarcasm, lest you think that I'm alone, you also have a letter here from the Mid-Willamette Valley Mayors Coalition, 9 mayors from cities of all different sizes in the Mid-Willamette Valley, saying that this is a lousy idea and the companion bill that goes with it. It's bad for cities, and I urge you to vote no on that. I turn it over to my colleague from Monmouth, Larry Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives.
I agree wholeheartedly with what John has said and the others.
Dalton, if we can get you to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. My name's Larry Dalton. I'm the mayor of Monmouth and a businessman in the community. The one thing that I would like to really stress is that this is very bad for rural communities. As John has said, that addressed the need. There was two needs that the city needed. One was economic and one was quality of life. What we've done is gone out and created that. You know, we've done it in a competitive basis. What our system is set up for is to allow anybody that is willing to come in and create a business or other businesses that are existing to use the facilities or the network, the fiber optic that we have, to use it for their businesses. So we're creating economic a stimulus for our communities. If this bill passes, what's going to happen to other rural communities? Thank you.
Thank you. Sir.
My name is Rob Bovet, Assistant County Counsel from Lincoln County. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you briefly about House Bill 2443. I'm going to cut it really short because I agree with what five folk before you said wholeheartedly. I have some written testimony, and I'll summarize it in one sentence. House Bill 2443 would be a violation of the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996, and I think would rapidly lead to federal litigation to declare it preempted, even as amended by the proponents, or as proposed to be amended by the proponents. But more fundamentally, I guess what I'd like to point out to you is the example in Lincoln County, we have something called CoastNet, which is a fiber optic system. We have a license to provide retail service, although right now we're only providing wholesale service because that's what's the best for our community. Our biggest customer right now is Quest. But in terms of costs, let's talk just briefly about some of the costs that Lincoln County has incurred in this CoastNet project with it and its partners. We haven't incurred any hard costs at all. We have incurred some soft costs, and that's namely me, my time, my investment in the CoastNet project, and that has all been incurred as a result of litigation that's wound its way up to the Oregon Supreme Court and back down again as direct frontal challenges by Verizon and Quest to home rule power. As a result, we got probably what is arguably the most significant home rule case out of the Oregon appellate courts last year in the last, I'd say, quarter century that affirmed the home rule powers of counties and cities. And that's important, I think, to understand where we're actually spending our money defending what we're doing here. It's soft costs, but it's an important project to Lincoln County, and it's an important power to have for cities and counties, especially in the rural areas that are underserved by the technology revolution. You get left behind in this particular revolution. It's like almost being left off the interstate in the 30s and 40s. You're being left out, hung out to dry. Now, they may get to you in 2013 or 2014 or whenever they decide to wire you up, but some of these communities are trying to do self-help. And posing entry barriers, not only is it a violation of federal law, it just flies in the face of the policy set by Congress back in 1996, which is to remove and strip away entry barriers to foster competition. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
Sure. I'm going to let, I'd like
Elaine Stewart.
She's also my ride.
Mr. Chair, my name is Elaine Stewart, and I'm president of the Monmouth Independence Chamber of Commerce. I really don't have too much to add here because we had some good speakers, but one of the primary interests of the chamber is to provide economic development, getting businesses into town, and I think I'm very proud of what our cities have done as far as getting broadband and telecommunications in here. We had, like the mayor said, joint chamber meetings. We had public meetings. We had discussions with business people. And the comments, the response has all been positive. And there is a lot of excitement when we got this in. And my only wish is that if you would review this bill very carefully and just ask yourself one question. By passing this bill, will this benefit our cities, or would it be a detriment to our cities? I thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's see. Scott Lazenby, Bill Willoughby, and Rob Myers. And Colleagues, we have received written testimony. Those who have not testified, has been handed around to you. So just make sure that those are entered in for the record. Ms. Lesme.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Scott Lazenby. I'm the city manager for the city of Sandy. I will leave written testimony from Mayor Linda Malone from the city of Sandy, so I won't repeat that. We do provide a very small-scale municipal telecommunications service as a city municipality. The Charter Cable, which is, in our case, our local headquarters, is in Hood River. Not only is it a different county, it's a different area code. They do not provide any broadband service and have no immediate plans to do so in our area. And it was frankly in an act of desperation as a sort of backwater area to the Portland metro area that we decided to get into this in the first place. And we obviously went through a very open hearing and analysis process before even venturing into it. And the method we do use, because we do contract with Verizon for most of the line services and with a private mom and pop company for the ISP services, and the city basically is the utility that sort of glues it together. And I can the testimony I'll leave has comments from the citizens in our area that are overwhelmingly supportive of the city of Sandy doing this, and I can assure you that the majority of Oregon citizens that live in our community would really like your help in seeing that this bill is dropped from any further consideration. Thank you.
And Roger Bennett, if I can get you to come up on deck here, since you're from Florence, I want to make sure you get covered as well before we go. Sorry, Mr. Willoughby.
Mr. Chair and representatives, my name is Bob Willoughby, and I am the city administrator in Cascade Locks. And I agree with the comments that the others have given already in opposition to this. I just want to highlight some things that haven't been mentioned, I guess, so far that occur to me. The city of Cascade Locks has provided cable TV service for 30 years, more than 30 years now, and we've been in the broadband business for over a year now. We are the cable TV company because no private company would come to our rural, isolated community and provide the service. We are in the broadband business for the same reason. We had the same response from Sprint that the other cities that are testifying had, and we couldn't even get a date. It wasn't 2013 or 2014. It was maybe never. And so when you heard about the intense competition that's out there, understand that that may be the case in Portland, but that isn't the case in Cascade Locks, and I suspect if you get outside of Portland in the real rural Oregon that there is no competition at all, and if you're fortunate, you have one private company that provides these telecom services. In Cascade Locks, for cable TV, we had none. Also, there was a suggestion that cities ought to focus on essential services, and I can assure you that in rural Oregon and in Cascade Locks, trying to survive in the gorge after our last mill closed more than 20 years ago now, our need for jobs and economic development is desperate. We have had chronic unemployment. Our welfare and our poverty levels are extremely high. Our high school is threatened with closure. We've lost all of our community infrastructure. And so for somebody to suggest that broadband is not an essential service lives in a different world than I do. And one other point, we also went through a very public process. We had a number of committee public meetings by a committee that looked at this, and we invited the private telecom companies to attend those meetings and to contribute to the discussion. We had public hearings and public meetings at our city council level, and our meetings were also televised. All the meetings were televised. And in fact, we went beyond that, and a rare volunteer that we had working for us called every household in Cascade Locks and discussed the possibility of doing this, tried to assess the need, the interest in doing this, and whether or not we could pay for the system if we did try and offer this service ourselves, because we knew that if we didn't do it, like with cable TV, it wasn't going to happen. And we got support from the community. They knew what we were doing. And it was a very open and public process. And I guess one final comment, if there is a concern that the public needs the right to have an election on issues like this one, you know, I personally don't see the connection between the development of public policy and the election process, but there already is legislation and a provision in the Oregon Constitution to allow anyone in the public that wants to question any decision by a city, such as to go into the telecom business, to file an initiative petition and require an election anytime they like.
Thank you. With just 4 minutes left, there are three others on what will comprise the final panel that we will not get to, and I apologize to you for that, but we will, of course, if we bring this back in work session, then we'll make sure that you folks are heard at that time. So, Mr. Myers?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Myers, and I live in Condon. I'll talk quickly. I represent Gillum, Sherman, and Wheeler Counties, Frontier Telenet, the Frontier Learning Network, and Eastern Oregon Rural Alliance. Just to give you an idea of what the world is like where I live, there are 5,000 people in three counties spread over 4,000 square miles, and suffice it to say that it's very difficult to make a legitimate business case for any private enterprise to deploy infrastructure across the area and serve those people. So rather than dwell on that, we're not really talking about economic development in our area. We're talking about survival. And I'm not talking about survival 10 years down the road. If we don't make it in the next 3 or 4 years, we aren't going to make it. For all intents and purposes, we see that one of the primary keys, if not the key, to our economic survival is access to affordable bandwidth. And for all intents and purposes, 2443 would deny us the right to save ourselves. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Bennett. I'm city manager of Florence. I bring you greetings of the mayor and council of the city of Florence. Much of what I would have to say has already been said, so I won't repeat it, but there's a couple of things that are obvious that need to be said. First of all, the cities do not exist to provide competition for private sector communities. The cities don't exist to provide a normal business-like enterprise. We exist to provide essential services to our community. We exist to provide the expectations of the citizens for quality of life facilities. And in as much as the private sector does not step into the communities, as the example showed by Cascade Locks, we have to step in and assure the citizens of the community the quality of life things that are necessary for competitive life today. Communications is a very critical quality of life issue, and it is a basic necessity in communities. There is a cyber gap between rural communities and some of the larger communities. I won't try to emphasize that. But I would offer that in Florence, the state mandated fiber optic ring completion is not yet complete. We are the last portion of the Oregon fiber optic network that isn't complete. And only Monday was the fiber from Eugene to Florence enacted and is not yet under contract by the private sector provided, by the private sector provider mandated to complete the thing. The resources weren't put in place by the public sector. Central Lincoln People's Utility District did the construction, put them in place so that they could be leased by the private sector. So the entrance of into the field by the public sector is critical to serve our communities. Yeah, the obvious point I would make is that in Oregon cities, there are two elections that already take place that determine the ability to offer such services as utilities as well as governmental services. Every community has to elect and adopt a charter. That charter is an enabling document that allows cities to provide utility services as well as normal governmental services. There is a separation under law between utility provision, entrepreneurial activities, and governmental services, and we maintain that and separate it. With that, I thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony. Nothing further, members. The public hearing is closed, and we are adjourned.
Wow. Okay.
You made it pretty good.